This is a download from the BBC. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Hello. Today, direct film, as Mark Cousins describes how he took cinema back to basics in Kurdistan, bringing movies to the people and letting them make their own in return. Essential Film, the pared-down drama of a living man stuck in a coffin underground for 90 minutes. Director Rodrigo Cortez will explain why his thriller Buried is a big story from a restricted place. And film history with a minor injustice from half a century ago. Best actor at the Cannes Film Festival 1962, Murray Melvin, in the British classic A Taste of Honey, reveals the reason he never got to pick up his award.
I was in a review of Willis Hall and Keith Waterhouse's called England, Our England, and we had a matinee, and they wouldn't let me out of it. Today, if your Auntie Nora had toothache, they'd let you out from a show and put an understudy on.
More Murray Melvin stories later. We'll start, though, with a film with a simple title, The First Movie, made by Mark Cousins, former director of the Edinburgh Film Festival, historian, academic, evangelist for the medium and filmmaker. Mark and a small team travelled to a village in Iraqi Kurdistan called Goptapa and literally brought cinema into local life by rigging up a screen after dark with sheets in the street to show an eclectic selection of international films and by giving small digital cameras to children to fashion their own mini features. Well, Mark joins us now on the line from Edinburgh. Why, Mark, did you choose this village?
Well, Francine, my producer and I drove around the north of Iraq and we're looking for something. You know, when you're making films, obviously you're looking up for a visual place, so it needed to be that. And then quickly I realised that I wanted to get to know the kids in my film, and so I couldn't film in a big city because there'd be gazillions of kids, you know. So we chose this village. It was on a mountaintop looking down to a sort of Oxbow Lake River. Gorgeous, beautiful little mosque, and only about 90 kids. And I just thought, this is about manageable for me. You know, my brain couldn't really tell a bigger story than the story of a little village.
And this is a community with a painful history, not in the immediate present, then going back some.
Yeah, this one village was gassed on the 3rd of May in 1985, I think it was. And I think 16% of the population died on that day. So this is huge. This is a vast trauma. I mean, I wasn't going there to make a film about trauma. I was going there to make a film about the kind of vitality of kids and how life goes on and the fact that we don't bomb the imagination and the hope out of people. So I didn't know where the sort of tragedy of the story would come, if it would come at the beginning, middle and the end. But as soon as I put the cameras on the kids, they quite happily talked about the sad stuff as well as the happy stuff. And I came to realise that it's quite easy for kids to flick from one to the other. Adults, the gears change more slowly, you know, but kids go happy, sad, happy very fast. And that was fascinating for me, you know, it all came out.
And you also make connections in the film between these children and your own experience.
Yes.
growing up in Northern Ireland.
Yes.
What role did film fulfil for you at that time?
This was the 70s when I was growing up. Not a good time for Northern Ireland, it has to be said, but cinema attendance was really low. So I found myself sitting in cinemas in Belfast on my own almost. It felt as if the movie was happening for me. I could feel myself unwind. I could feel a kind of quietude in the cinema as the lights went down and a kind of self-loss and unravelling of self that I just absolutely adored and wanted more of, like you want more of a drug. So then when I went to Iraq, I hadn't really thought about this and didn't intend to have me in the picture much. But when I was working with the kids, I started to see their pure rapture at seeing movies, and they'd never seen a movie on the big screen before. The pure unbridled joy. And I started to remember rather fondly my former self.
So why did you choose the films that you did? What were those?
That was easy for me, Francine. I've been sort of ridiculously fascinated by kids' films for so long now that I'd been making a mental list of great ones. I wanted to bring films that were not dialogue heavy, that were very visual, that emphasised the dreamlike properties of film, perhaps, you know, the poetic properties, you know, because the journalists have had a go at Iraq and they have used prose, but I think that the more sort of poetic approach was what I was trying to get at. So I tried to show rather poetic films and it seemed to go down a treat.
Yeah, what was their reaction? I mean, what was the thing that most surprised you that they latched onto?
They loved an Iranian film I showed called The Boot, made by Muhammad Ali Talebi. They loved it, you know, because it was about a little girl and she was a stroppy little girl and they loved her stroppiness. They loved the ending of E.T. I showed E.T. and they loved all that and the bikes. And they sat through all the, you know, all those scenes in E.T. which are like around a dinner table. It's quite suburban, you know, quite detailed about Americana. But they seemed to get through all that without being restive. But then when we showed them the Ballon Rouge, the red balloon, they just went wild, you know, and tried to grab the balloon. And they actually did like the hokey cokey almost, you know, that as the balloons were going into the air, you know, they couldn't contain themselves. And if you ever need to be reminded the pure childhood joy of cinema, then that reminded me of it.
And when you gave them cameras to go off and make their own little films, obviously these are not kids who are steeped in visual entertainment
No.
So did it surprise you the kind of range of approaches that they took?
Well, even before I gave them cameras, I noticed that when I got my camera out, they lined up in a rather theatrical way in front of the camera. And then when I started to look at their own work, it was noticeably good. I think probably better than kids here would do, even though, as you say, they're not steeped in visual culture. And this is the part of the world, of course, that came up with some of the many stories of Scheherazade and 1001 Nights, Arabian Nights, Aladdin, etc. So there's a magic there. And if, in a way, you know, you could say that cinema is like riding a magic carpet, you know, and it looked like it to those kids. And when I was talking to them about the story, what they would want to do ideally in the world, they kept talking about floating and dreaming and everything. And so their little films had this kind of magic quality, which was fantastic.
So now you brought that to them and you allow them the chance to express themselves.
Yes.
Now what? Is there a legacy to your visit?
Yeah, it's quite hard to get back there, Francine, to be honest. You know, I would love to go back now and tell them, you know, we've been having nice reviews for this film and blah, 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 and it's getting screenings. So I'd love to go back and show them that, but it's quite hard. And we're doing a sort of theatrical release of the picture starting today, and it's going around all the picture house cinemas in the UK, and we're going to take our box office from that and buy cameras and computers and things and bring it back to the village and just sort of leave them there, plant them there, and if the kids are interested, they can use them and make of them what they want.
Well, Mark Cousins, thanks very much indeed for the time being. And as Mark said, the first movie will be playing in cinemas around the country during October. And you can see the details of where it'll be on our website at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Murray Melvin is an actor with an unforgettable face, mournful, watchful, sharp and droll all at once. It's now nearly half a century since he made the film that won him Best Actor at the Cannes Film Festival, A Taste of Honey, set in 1950s Salford, which was based on Sheila Delaney's play. Melvin was Jeffrey, an artistic loner who befriends and cares for a young, pregnant girl played by Rita Tushingham. And the film, directed by Tony Richardson, is one of the key works of the British New Wave. Murray Melvin would go on to work with Ken Russell on a number of films, including a pivotal role as a father confessor in the 1971 film The Devils, based on Aldous Huxley's novel of religious hysteria and sexual frustration in 17th century France. Russell's film, which didn't hold back in its imagination of hysterical frenzy, the famous orgiastic naked nun scene, has long been suppressed or overlooked. Later, amongst many film appearances, Murray Melvin would work with Stanley Kubrick. Well, he's still working at 78, still associated with the theatre Stratford East, where he began with Joan Littlewood's Theatre Workshop.
Well, I don't come from a theatrical family. It sort of just happened that after the war, my parents started a youth club, and somebody in the youth club started a drama section. And one week she said, "Now, listen, I want us all to meet next week, but we're not going to be here. I want to take you all to the theatre." Now, she said, "It's a long way away. I'm living at the time in Hampstead." She said, "This theatre's in Stratford East, London." And we were, "Where's Stratford?" You'd never heard of it. But she said, "I once saw this wonderful company. They're called the Theatre Workshop, and it's run by a lady called Joan Littlewood. And I consider them to be the finest theatre I have seen. So I want to take you all so that you experience this." And so, after work, we all met and we did this very long journey out to Stratford. When we got there, what we were seeing was Richard II with Harry H. Corbett as Richard.
This was before Steptoe.
Oh, long before. And I can remember practically every second of it because you were on the edge of your seats. And it just was implanted. And then much later she said to me, Murray, you know, I think you have a talent. And I think we must get you to Joan Littlewood at Stratford. And she did.
And so it was always the stage at that stage. I mean, cinema was not the thing about which you had particular ambition.
Oh, Francis. Oh, Alice Faye. Astaire. Oh, no. Garbo. Cocteau. Well, living in Hampstead, we had the Everyman Theatre. That was my education for films. French cinema, come on, it was... Little did I know that I would be in our new wave cinema when I was once looking at theirs.
Of course, Taste of Honey, you had been playing the role of Jeff on stage since spring of 58.
Yes.
And then Tony Richardson came along to do the film version. Mm. Now, did it seem like an easy transition? Did it seem that automatically you go at that stage from stage to screen?
No. But, of course, the film was 2 years after I'd done the stage play. By which time, of course, I'd played that boy for almost a year. And so I knew him well. I mean, I got him through... Remember, Joan's Theatre was... We were all dancers. We were all Laban-based. And I got it all through movement rather than anything. It's not there in the lines. It's solely from the movement of my body.
And the role of Jeff, I mean, Jeff is a really interesting character, I think, looking at the film now, because he has... Now people describe him as a gay character, but it was never, ever...
He couldn't have been, because the Lord Chamberlain would never have allowed it on stage. I mean, we didn't have the word gay. Come on, you know, that's just a modern... No. So he had to represent something that... wasn't allowed. It's interesting, in the first reviews at Stratford, they skirt the subject. It's not till we actually come into town to the Wyndhams, to the second one, that somebody mentions that, I think somebody mentioned that he was a lovely word used in those days, a pansy. Well, we have come on a little bit. By the time we got into town, yes, one realised we were groundbreaking in many, many ways.
And the French certainly recognised at Cannes in 1962 when you won Best Actor and Rita Tushingham also Best Actress. I mean, an extraordinary thing there, the Cannes Film Festival, British films.
Do you know, I wasn't there.
Why not?
Oh, Francine, I wasn't. No, because I was in a review of Willis Hall and Keith Waterhouse's called England, Our England. And we had a matinee, and they wouldn't let me out of it. Today, if your Auntie Nora had toothache, they'd let you out from a show and put an understudy on. Then you had to literally be dying and get a doctor's certificate before you could miss a show.
So did you get no kind of congratulatory ceremony or anything?
No. So what does it mean, anyway?
Well, it must have changed something. Best Actor at Cannes. I mean, there's...
Oh, out of work for a year.
Why, do you think? I mean...
It very often happens. I think you... I don't know what it is. I was out of work for one whole year. Extraordinary, isn't it? So I never mentioned it. I never mentioned it to anybody. I thought, oh, I'm never going to mention that again because I'll never get a job.
Now, towards the end of the 60s and early 70s, you start working with Ken Russell. Now, how did you meet Ken Russell?
We were doing Oh, What a Lovely War, another little something that Miss Littlewood threw off. and we were at Wyndham's, and myself and Brian Murphy, who was in the show, a member of Joan's company, we got a script, just sent a script by our agent saying, do you want to do this part? It was a Diary of a Nobody. And there it was. I mean, we got the parts. We didn't have to see him, meet him, till the day we were there. And then the next was The Devils.
It was not an easy production, I would imagine.
That's the understatement of the interview, Francine, I think. No, it was. Well, it was the subject that was horrendous.
OK, it's a very harrowing subject, and he chose to represent it in a very graphic form, was certainly some of the nuns' religious fervour, and indeed the scenes of torture. Was it always going to be as excessive as some people perceive it to be from the outset?
We were working for Ken.
There was no too far.
No. Well, there was occasionally. Yes, yes, I had to do a shot, which was not nice. Well, it's that thing, isn't it? You know, if you're not a flasher, you're not a flasher. It was harrowing. But you saw Ken's vision, and Ken asked you and you did.
And then you went on, of course, to be Berlioz in Listomania, so you carried on the Ken Russell connections.
You've heard, have you, of my costume fitting? He was going to do a film on Berlioz. And I went for a costume fitting with Shirley Russell.
Who was his wife at that stage.
Absolutely.
And did the costumes for him.
And did all those wonders. Oh, what a genius. And she said, all right. Now, she said, immediately after lunch, you're on set. I said, what do you mean on set? I said, but I've only just... She said, well, Ken's using you in this. I said, what do you mean... I haven't come down to be filmed. I've come down for a costume fitting. But, of course, it was Ken. So I went on stage and there was three. What other director would audition a frock for his next film on the film that he was doing? Now, come on. So there was three of us. He got three. And then, having got the three of us there, he said, now, what are we going to do? I said, I don't know what we're going to do, Ken. And he went... Oh, I know. He turned to Tommy Props and said, Tommy, get me three ice cream cornets. And we're standing there licking the ice. That's the scene.
When you look at your career, do you feel frustrated that there are the kinds of parts that were not offered to you or that maybe you were sometimes a bit typecast?
I know my list of credits goes on like some roll call.
80-something on
IMDb. But very often, that's just one scene. Just as much hard work finding a character for one scene. And sometimes, if you rather like that character, you do that one scene, you think, oh, that's a shame. Would have liked to have moved him on a bit. That's always a bit of a disappointment. But I've done so many that I just think, oh, wasn't I lucky? I was a very lucky lad.
Murray Melvin and A Taste of Honey is available on DVD, certificate PG. Last week we asked you to tell us about local film heroes for our up-and-coming cinema season on Radio 4. Not-for-profit cinemas, film clubs, festivals and so on. Places where people have simply got together for the love of film and the chance to talk about it. Via emails and letters, we've heard from film societies, such as the Valleys Film Society in Mid Wales, which runs a challenge to make a 5-minute film in 10 days, and it lends out cameras and, neat touch this, one prop drawn from a hat. Members of the Empire Community Cinema in Chorley, on the other hand, actually get into costume western or whatever's called for the screening, and they also show old newsreels of the area, including footage of King George visiting Chorley in 1913. There have also been submissions from groups of volunteers who've taken over and run their local cinema. Shirley Hambleton, for example, has helped to save the Regal in Tenbury Wells from closure. Others are trying to save or even reopen their local cinemas. So that might be the Theatre Gwan in Fishguard, the Picture Palace in Guildford, or the Grand Theatre in Woolwich. And Emma Lee from Primate Productions, a non-profit cooperative, offers this arresting image.
This year we set up the very first film festival in our town, Whitley Bay. We launched the festival with a screening of Jaws on the beach. Many said it couldn't be done. It's tidal, we were told. But with careful planning, timing and many, many local volunteers, we managed to erect 200 deck chairs and a marquee on our beach, screen the film and even set off an explosion when Jaws is blown up at the end, and get it all done again before the tide came back in.
Mark Cousins, you and Tilda Swinton devised and launched a film festival in Nairn, didn't you?
Yeah, we started... It's funny listening to those stories. Yeah, we did one thing called the Ballerina Ballroom Cinema of Dreams in Nairn. Tilda saw an old building, which was a lovely old building, a bit smelly, I have to say, a bit dank. And she said, you know, could we put beanbags in here and do a little film festival? I said, yeah. And we did, and we charged almost nothing, £3, £2. You got in free if you brought fairy cakes. People started queuing from 8 in the morning for silent Japanese films, you know. And I think that communities have always had the desire to get together, you know, and film festivals are just the latest occasion. And especially, to be honest, when people spend more and more of their time online, offline, looks very, very seductive indeed. And I think that's why there's this blossoming, you know. Hopefully it's also fed by cinephilia, you know.
And Mark, thanks very much indeed for the time being. More suggestions for local cinema heroes, please. You can contact us at the film programme, all one word, at bbc.co.uk or at BBC Broadcasting House, London W1A1AA. Well, Mark's film, the first movie that we were just talking about, concerns a community that's caught with the legacy of war. A new thriller in cinemas this weekend uses the conflict in Iraq as the premise for a daring exercise. An American truck driver working for a contractor there wakes up to find himself in a wooden box buried below ground. Well, if even that idea makes you gasp for breath, then brace yourself. The film lasts 94 minutes and never once does it leave that claustrophobic location. The man, played by Ryan Reynolds, has only one erratic link to the outside, a mobile phone with limited reception and battery. Rodrigo Cortez, the film's director, is Spanish. He makes plain his debt to Hitchcock in the opening titles. So I asked him what he learnt from the master.
Actually, the great lesson that you can learn from him is that real time and real space don't matter. Only cinematical time and space. Because you can stretch it and you can compress it. And those are the tools you have as a filmmaker if you try to achieve something impossible, as shooting a 94 minutes inside a box is.
And also, the whole 94 minutes is full of Hitchcockian ironies, isn't it? Because you have this very extreme, terrible situation. But into that, which draws the audience in, you introduce kind of ordinary, everyday things, the frustrations of everyday life.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, the real enemy that Paul Connery has is not darkness nor even lack of oxygen or the sand, but probably bureaucracy. So you cannot fight human mediocrity, and which is pretty Hitchcockian too, because you have the wrong guy inside a box trying to fight something bigger than him. And in some way, and this is very perverted, I always saw Buried as a comedy somehow. And you have to have a perfect balance. This has to be a roller coaster, because this is a movie to be experienced more than a movie to be seen. I mean, yeah, you experience it not only with your eyes, but also with your bones, with your flesh, with your body, with your blood, with your skin, literally. That's the reason why people leave the theater 4 pounds lighter.
And the idea of having 94 minutes of a man in a box underground, how difficult was that to sell when you were trying to raise money to start with?
Yeah, you're right. That's the hard part. And I can tell you that from the beginning, I received every kind of, let's call them, kind suggestions in order to cut out to the other side of the line, to show the surface, to show the other characters. But in my opinion, that was the perfect way of ruining everything. I always saw this story as something big, and not in spite of its elements, but because of them. And paradoxically, if you shoot the surface, you're going to have a smaller film. This is going to be like a TV episode. You have to keep everybody inside Paul Connery's film. And I remember that at the beginning they told me, so you are going to do experimental film, obscure, good for museums. And the answer always was, no, this is going to be Indiana Jones in a box. We are not even going to do Lifeboat in a box. We are going to do North by Northwest inside a box.
So what is the difference then between the kind of art installation you might get in a gallery, which, or even an Iranian film, a Kiarostami film, where you might just be on one person's face? What do you introduce that's different?
What I did is not to use common sense. That was different because I didn't use logic. If you focus on the location, you're going to focus on the restrictions, on the things that you cannot do. So we designed and built 7 different boxes with 7 different needs. One of them had collapsible walls we could take out and place in while the camera described the circle. Another one could turn over. Another one was specially reinforced so Ryan could push as hard as he could. So he didn't need to pretend, but you could literally feel the pressure of tons of sand. Well, I mean, everything that we needed to make possible the impossible.
But was there never a moment, even with all that preparation, where you sat in the edit suite and thought, you know, maybe I'm doing something that is too much, that I haven't got enough variety here?
It didn't happen. It should happen. A couple of days before the beginning of the shooting, I saw one of the coffins and I looked at it carefully and I saw this very reduced space and I thought, okay, I'm going to do a 94 minute inside that box, and I felt some vertigo. So I stopped that feeling. I decided not to think again. Just focus on the needs of every take, one by one. So, no, I didn't feel any doubt because I didn't allow doubt to happen.
And could the film be read in any way as an allegory about intervention in Iraq?
If we use Hitchcockian terms, I would say that Iraq, it's the MacGuffin, in the sense that it's the background. But these small premise stories do have very powerful allegoric and metaphoric level. But in my opinion, goes beyond politics and beyond ideologies. But there's something more important here. The real enemy, as we said before, is bureaucracy. And one of the reasons why people feel so committed with this character is not because they remember that they were buried alive last weekend, hopefully, but because they tried to change their cell phone company and they spent 20 minutes just pressing one and pressing two, obeying the voice of a robot. And when at last you speak with a human being, you find out that you are just a problem and the other guy just wants you to be anybody else's problem. So that's what I see it as, a very dark comedy somehow. And this goes beyond countries, beyond political systems, and at least in the Western world, everybody can feel totally committed with it.
And that was Rodrigo Cortez, director of Buried, which is in cinemas, Certificate 15. Well, Mark Cousins still with us on the line from Edinburgh. Mark, I know you've seen Buried. I mean, it sounds like it could be, you know, Iranian film. It could be something completely experimental. There's one man, one box, 94 minutes. Is this, in a sense, do you think, a kind of reaction against there being so much else going on in terms of plot and visuals and all the things we can show?
Yeah, I think so. I think that a lot of filmmakers, and whether like Hitchcock because they want to challenge themselves or whether they want to challenge other dominant modes of filmmaking, you know, the mainstream, so to speak, are trying to limit their palette. And look what Dogma did in the 90s, the Danes, you know, with their Dogma manifesto. They wanted to limit themselves and then see if they could still make drama. And this director clearly can and clearly does. I think this compares rather well to the Hitchcock film Lifeboat. I think it's as good, if not better, which could be high praise. But the strange thing is, in giving it a political context, it reduces the resonance of the picture. It doesn't have enough mystery about it. I think it doesn't have a kind of Beckett-like existential quality. You know, it falls flat every time we realise that it's about this place in the real world, I think.
Mark Cousins, thank you very much indeed. It's been a crowded week in the departure lounge of cinema history. Tony Curtis, of course, has gone, and the day after his 88th birthday, director Arthur Penn, whose film career began in 1958 with Paul Newman as angry young cowboy Billy the Kid in The Left-Handed Gun. Arthur Penn provided prominent showcases for other young male stars of the era, Marlon Brando and Warren Beatty, who brought in the script for the film for which he'll probably be best remembered, Bonnie and Clyde, in 1967. Well, together with Alice's Restaurant in 1969 and Little Big Man in 1970, Penn seemed to find a way of simultaneously entertaining while sticking the knife into American heroes and heroics. On next week's show, Rhys Evans. But since the mood is a touch elegiac, let's finish with a great movie ending, since the man who uttered this line, actor Joe Mantell, who played sidekick to Jack Nicholson's Private Eye in Chinatown, also died this week.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.